From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Casey Morrell, sitting in for Jim Flink. In March 2011, an earthquake and tsunami devastated the eastern coast of Japan. Thousands of people were killed, and scores more were displaced as a result of the natural disaster. The earthquake and resulting tsunami caused the meltdown of a nuclear power station located in Fukushima Prefecture. Radioactive material leaked into the Pacific Ocean, and the area surrounding the plant became irradiated. This led to the development of an exclusion zone around the plant and the evacuation of cities near the stricken nuclear site. But more than 3 years after the event, journalists still struggle to report on what exactly is going on with the region's recovery and cleanup efforts. TEPCO, the utility that managed the nuclear reactor, has been criticized for not being forthcoming with the public or with the victims of the tragedy, or even with the government itself. Today on Global Journalist, we take a look at what's going on in Fukushima and look at some of the challenges reporters face in covering stories like these in Japan. We are joined from Tokyo by James Corbett, who is the founder of FukushimaUpdate.com, and from Columbia, Missouri by Steve Starr, who is the Program Director of Clinical Laboratory Science at the University of Missouri School of Health Professions. He is also a former board member for Physicians for Social Responsibility. And gentlemen, I want to thank you very much for coming on Global Journalist today. James, I'd like to start with you. Can you just give us a little bit of background? What is the current situation like in and around the exclusion zone? Have people been able to come back at any time to see what their old houses look like, to collect any types of belongings? Can you just bring us up to date on what's going on in and around Fukushima right now?
Well, there have been more people who have been able to return for day visits to see their old homes and collect items that they need, and that has been gradually happening more and more in recent months. But I think that the one of the underplayed and underreported aspects of this crisis all around is really the social effects and the family effects on these home lives that have been completely torn apart by the disaster. And just as an example of that, back in April, there was the results of a survey that was released that showed nearly one half of all of the Fukushima evacuees have been forced to split up. One half of the families that were evacuated as a result of this have been forced to split up and live in separate locations for various reasons, work or school related reasons. That's a pretty stunning figure in and of itself. And unfortunately, an even sadder figure from that survey showed that 70% of those families had members that were suffering from some form of mental illness or distress or depression, which is perhaps not surprising given the severity of this, but unfortunately it's still quite a tragedy. And that's, I think, one of the underreported aspects of this tragedy, because the only people who are really attempting to deal with this, supposedly, are TEPCO and the Japanese government. And there are huge concerns about the way they're attempting to do that and whether it's too little, too late, and whether they're just refusing to provide compensation to some of these people altogether.
Well, from your vantage point, what has the coverage of the recovery been like in Japan? Is it something that's still been on the radar for the most part, more than 3 years afterwards? Or is it something that's kind of lingering in the subconscious, but not necessarily at the fore?
I would say it is still on the radar, but it is certainly further towards the periphery of that radar than it was, obviously, at the time of the disaster and in the immediate wake. And I think it's been displaced by economic concerns and some of the concerns over the remilitarization of Japan that have really moved this off of the center of the table when it comes to the political discussion here. And as a result, of that, and also as a result of, I think, the nature of the news cycle itself, we've just seen the story has been covered in all of the ways that it can be covered, and now it seems to be more in an update type of cycle, so that when there is new developments to report, they'll be reported on. But there doesn't seem to be a lot of investigative work going on at this point, especially, of course, from the mainstream media here.
Has it been difficult for the media, be it the mainstream media, more, I guess, as we would say now, untraditional sources of media, social media and those types, to get access either into the exclusion zone or information from TEPCO and the government itself? James?
Yes, well, of course, access to the exclusion zone itself and the immediate vicinity of the plant has been restricted and continues to be and is heavily monitored by the authorities so that only approved and credentialed journalists can get in with the express permission of TEPCO and usually on guided tours of the facilities. So I think what we have to conclude is that a lot of the reporting that comes out of those types of officially guided tours is certainly sanitized for the public consumption. And that is one of the key, I think, problems of reporting on this story is the question of access, which is not only related to this particular issue, but also goes to the way that the Japanese journalism profession is structured, with the infamous Kisha clubs, as they're called, which is basically an organization that credentialed and accredited journalists from the mainstream major newspapers and major television outlets have access to, which gives them direct access to government officials. But for anyone on the periphery of that, anyone who is not part of that of those clubs and not one of the mainstream official accredited reporters, they do not have access to those officials. They are not able to ask questions or get answers from the people who are directly dealing with this situation. So that is a definite a roadblock to would-be journalists from the periphery that would like to try to cover this. And now, just late last year, there was the passage of the state secrecy bill in the Japanese parliament, which is bringing in even further regulations on the potential for whistleblowers to blow the whistle on Fukushima, presumably, or any other government-related matter, that will see such whistleblowers subject to 10 years imprisonment. And unfortunately, the wording of that act was so vague, simply applying to any sort of government secret, that really almost anything could conceivably fall under it, just given the way that the Japanese government deems to classify the information. So it certainly does at least present the possibility that information from Fukushima that otherwise would have gotten out from certain sources will not now get out because of people being basically afraid to try to blow the whistle at this point.
And Steve Starr, your research looks at the lingering effects of radiation on populations, on communities, both from, I guess, a health standpoint and a social standpoint. You've also looked at Chernobyl. Do you think that some of the reactions that the Japanese government and TEPCO have had to this are similar to what we saw in the aftermath of Chernobyl?
Oh, yes. I mean, there's a lot of similarities to response has generally been orchestrated. After Chernobyl, the Soviet authorities made it illegal for physicians to diagnose radiation-related illnesses. I don't think it's quite that degree of control in Japan, but through PSR, we do hear that there's a lot of people are discouraged from looking at it and reporting certain things. But I think there's a larger question there would be what happened after the accident. The radiation safety standards in Japan were similar to those in the United States in terms of exposure before the accident. But there was about 11,000 square miles of mainland Japan that were significantly contaminated with long-lived radionuclides, particularly cesium-137, and about 4,500 square miles, or roughly the area of the state of Connecticut, was contaminated enough that, according to their earlier standards, those areas would have had to have been evacuated. So what Japan did was they multiplied times 20 for their safety standards. So it made it acceptable to live in all these areas, except, of course, in the radioactive exclusion zone that you mentioned, which is still about a couple hundred square miles. But when you get in an area that's significantly contaminated with cesium-137, which is the predominant radionuclide that's released in these when spent fuel at nuclear power plants is melted down or ruptured. The cesium becomes a gas. It's spread by the wind and it's rained out. There's a patchy deposition. It's never uniform, but these areas that are seriously contaminated, cesium's highly water soluble. It tends to get into the soils and it biomagnifies. It moves up. It concentrates as it moves up to different levels of the food chain. It also contaminates potassium-rich plants like berries and mushrooms, and it gets into the meat and dairy products. So if you subsist on food in these areas, which a lot of Japanese have to raise their own food, they're going to be a lot more at risk. We've seen that in the contaminated areas of Belarus. So there's a lot of implications there in terms of if you live in Japan and you're in areas that are contaminated. This, is, of course, has been a big area of dispute in the industry and the IAEA and various physicians groups and scientists. So I want to make it clear that there's an ongoing argument about what exactly is safe. I've mentioned earlier before the show that the U.S. Standards, and they're guidelines more than standards, but our FDA says it's, we set standards that are 12 times higher for the amount of radioactive cesium in our foodstuffs than Japan does. So Japan will have foodstuffs that are too radioactive for their own markets that they will undoubtedly ship to the United States for consumption here. So there's a lot of ramifications in terms of the radioactive contamination that's taking place.
You're listening to Global Journalist. I'm Casey Morrell. We are looking at recent developments in Fukushima and at some of the challenges reporters face in covering stories like these in Japan. We are joined by James Corbett, the founder of Fukushima Update, and by Steve Starr, who is the Program Director of Clinical Laboratory Science at the University of Missouri School of Health Professions. I want to remind you that you can listen to this and other full episodes of Global Journalist on our website. That's globaljournalist.org. For more Global Journalist content, you can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at Global Journ. Now, Steve, back to what you were saying, there was a quote that you had that was written in a PSR report that came out in April of 2011, just after the Fukushima incident. And you said, and I quote, "Every time we build and operate a nuclear reactor, we do so with the implicit assumption that we shall forever be able to contain the radioactive poisons we create in the reactor. In doing so, we presume that we can predict the future for centuries and millennia to come, that we can isolate and protect nuclear reactors and nuclear waste from every single catastrophe that nature and man can inflict, including earthquakes, tsunamis, volcanic eruptions, asteroids, human error, terrorism, and war. History has already shown us that such assumptions are indeed both foolish and futile." Do you think that putting this power station on the coast of Japan, where it was potentially tsunami-prone, was a disaster in the making, that it was something that was just already waiting to happen?
Well, yes, the design was very flawed in a lot of ways. They lowered the cliff. It was 115 feet above sea level, and they built the plant about 30 feet above sea level. There was a lot of historical records that showed that tsunamis had hit Japan that were 20 and 30 meters high. They built their seawall about 4.5 meters high to protect against it. They had their diesel generators in the basement. The water intake was at sea level, so everything got wiped out. But, you know, I want to also point out that the U.S. has 22 reactors of the same design as the ones at Fukushima Daiichi, and most of their spent fuel pools have a lot more radioactive waste in them than those in Japan. And just an average spent fuel pool in the U.S. has roughly about 1 million grams of cesium-137 in the fuel rods. And my research shows, if you look at the exclusion map of the Chernobyl, there's about 1,000 square miles around Chernobyl that are uninhabitable too. And they define that by how much cesium-137 is in the soil. And it takes about a little more than half a gram of cesium-137 to make a square kilometer uninhabitable, or it's about 1.2 grams to make a square mile uninhabitable. And you know, if you consider that there's 1 million grams in U.S. spent fuel pools, and there's 104 commercial reactors, and there's a lot of potential there for, even if there's no accident, you know, if everything works perfectly, we still have to isolate this stuff from the ecosystems and the biosphere for, you know, up to 1 million years. And I still say that there's really no viable design. I'm not sure how they can do that. I think deep underground storage is probably the best bet, but we've just seen that the waste isolation pilot plant out in New Mexico was closed because they had plutonium canisters blow up in there and contaminated radiation reach the surface. So I'm not sure. I don't think we're doing a very good job in planning ahead with this.
And James Corbett, do you think the government in Japan is doing enough for cleanup and recovery at this time, or have the people that you've talked to intimated that they feel as though they're confident in the recovery effort so far?
Quite the contrary. I would say that if anything, what this disaster at this moment represents is just a series of compounding errors, disaster upon disaster. And we see that in virtually everything that's applied to the site. And we have to keep in mind that, of course, what is happening at the site right now is not cleanup. They're not actually trying to mitigate the disaster itself. They're just trying to keep the effects of that disaster under control. And in order to do that, of course, they have to keep reactors 1, 2, and 3, the melted down cores of those reactors, constantly cooled by continually pumping in water, which is continually leaking down into the basements and contaminating groundwater flowing through the site, which is a huge and ongoing concern because, of course, there are just giant reservoirs of water that are being created of this contaminated water that they're attempting to store on site. But when they collect that water and put it into storage tanks that they've specially built on site for that purpose, the storage tanks themselves are leaking. Another example of this, in order to try to mitigate some of the problem with the groundwater flowing through the site, they've tried to build some bypasses to try to catch some of that groundwater before it flows through the basements and becomes contaminated. They've just come out in the last week or so, TEPCO has come out to admit that they don't know if this is having any effect at this moment. And they're still waiting to see if this will actually do anything. And of course, people have probably heard about this idea, this plan for an ice wall that they're going to build, a 1.5 kilometer perimeter around the plant to try to freeze the soil in order to stop the groundwater from flowing through the site. But again, this is completely experimental. This has been tried on very small scales before, but nothing of the size and magnitude of what they're trying now. And the timetable that was originally proposed for this of March 2015 seems that it's probably not going to come to fruition because of the problems they've been facing during the experimentation phase of this. So again, just about every aspect of what they're doing seems to be one step forward, two steps back. And unfortunately, that's the holding pattern that we've been in for a few years now. And because in late 2011, the Japanese government and TEPCO declared that the site was in cold shutdown, that was, I think, the point at which a lot of the media interest turned away from the issue because it seemed like everything was under control. But it's an ongoing problem. And as I say, every attempt to try to control that problem seems to be facing setbacks of its own.
But the interesting thing, James, at least from what I've seen, is that in the immediate aftermath of Fukushima, the government that was in power then, led by the Democratic Party, said, okay, we're done with nuclear power, we're going to start phasing it out. But when they were defeated in the next elections by the Liberal Democratic Party, the mood shifted, and Shinzo Abe's government has now said, hold on, nuclear power is still the best way for Japan to be energy independent. How are people reacting to that? Is there a lot of pushback against the government for wanting to reintroduce nuclear power?
Well, as you can imagine, this is obviously a very polarizing issue, and there are people obviously with economic interests and with other interests at stake in seeing the continuation of the nuclear status quo here, and then there is a very motivated anti-nuclear movement here that really does want to use this as the springboard towards the possible elimination of nuclear power from the islands of Japan themselves. And this is obviously still ongoing, but at this time, the nuclear industry really has the upper hand because, as you say, once the Shinzo Abe government came in late 2012, the idea of scrapping nuclear power was abandoned, and in fact, plans are to continue with the nuclear status quo. This is causing a lot of strife and turmoil. There's a lot of political turmoil going on here, not only related to the nuclear issue, obviously also related to the military, the militarization of Japan, related to the economic issues happening here. But I think they are all forming a piece, and it means there is a political movement that really is motivated and energized around this nuclear issue towards the idea of eliminating nuclear power. But it seems to be the wind has gone out of its sails since the LDP government of Shinzo Abe came in. And all of the really remarkable steps that were taken under the previous government, including that proposal to eliminate nuclear power, and including the fact that that previous government commissioned a report that actually concluded that Fukushima was a man-made disaster because it could have been prevented, it should have been foreseen because of all of the problems in the situation of the plant. These are pretty remarkable steps for a country that has been so wedded to nuclear power throughout much of the last half century. And all of those steps seem to have been erased with this new government. So there are certainly people who are against that, but the political momentum seems to be on the other side.
You're listening to Global Journalist. I'm Casey Morrell. We're looking at recent developments in Fukushima and also looking at some of the challenges reporters face in covering stories like these in Japan. We are joined by James Corbett, the founder of FukushimaUpdate.com, and by Steve Starr, who is the Program Director of Clinical Laboratory Science at the University of Missouri School of Health Professions. I want to remind you that you can listen to this and other full episodes of Global Journalist on our website. That's globaljournalist.org. And for more Global Journalist content, you can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at @GlobalJourn. Now, gentlemen, we only have a few minutes left. I'd like to ask you both what you think the lasting legacy of this incident is going to be. Are we going to start to see more countries that have been avowedly committed to nuclear power, you know, start to move in the opposite direction? We've seen Germany say that it wants to phase out nuclear power. France wants to reduce its commitment to nuclear power from the 75% that it has now down to about 50%. Is this part of a new trend that we're going to see, or do you think that it's something else, that maybe in a few years, once Fukushima fades back into the subconscious, we're not going to see these pushbacks anymore? James, I would like to start with you.
I think we're already starting to see the revivification of the nuclear industry, which obviously I think had to lie low in the immediate wake of this disaster. But at this point, I mean, Japan is once again going out and trying to export some of its nuclear technologies to other countries. And we see these plants and new plant construction is being proposed in a number of countries, India looking at the issue. And it is still a political struggle in a lot of places, and there are still a lot of opposition, but these projects are still going ahead, and the industry is still around at this point. So I'm not convinced that at this point that Fukushima really will be a turning point, but it could at least be a hallmark for future conversations, and I think will be a touchstone for future projects wherever they pop up. I'm sure Fukushima will enter into that conversation.
Do you think, James, in some way that it will be more of a rallying point or a touchstone, as you said, for the groups that were already committed to being anti-nuclear? In other words, it's not something that's necessarily going to persuade people who were in the pro-nuclear camp to go the other way?
Yes, I think that that to a large extent, this probably hasn't changed the mindsets of the people who already had their minds made up on the nuclear issue before this point. It may have swayed some of the people who were undecided, but I think a lot of the people who were already polarized on these issues are unlikely to change their positions because of them. Although there are some notable exceptions, and sometimes in the opposite direction. For example, there was the Guardian journalist George Monbiot, who of course writes on environmental issues, who famously said that he now embraces nuclear power because Fukushima showed that it's a relatively minor thing when a nuclear disaster happens. So it's kind of strange the way that this is.
Well, I don't know how he does his math. You know, I mean, I think if you look at just the cost of the property, the homes, the agricultural land, the industry that had to be abandoned, and the exclusion zone, and the cost of the cleanup, we're going to be pushing $500 billion. So that doesn't seem like a bargain to me. Arne Gundersen said that you can run a nuclear power plant perfectly, and then you can have one bad day after 40 years, and you can ruin half a country. And I think that's definitely been illustrated. I didn't mean to interrupt you, James.
I agree completely with your assessment there, and I think that is the part of this that gets excluded from the conversation often.
Right.
And that's particularly acute here in Japan, where of course the taxpayers are being asked to burden a lot of the cost of this cleanup and mitigation. Mm-hmm. And that's directly in the fact that TEPCO, of course, has been essentially nationalized. The controlling shareholder is now the Japanese government, or the agency that they created to deal with the cleanup. And tens of billions of dollars have already been pumped into this.
Right. Could I suggest that that we're a long way from seeing the end of this? One of the things that's not discussed is the spent fuel pools that are still sitting in blown-up reactor buildings, and the tops of these pools are 100 feet above ground, and they've gotten about half the fuel out of spent fuel pool number four. But if that pool were to collapse, if there was another major earthquake or tsunamis that would strike there, if that pool was breached and the fuel was spilled on the ground, they wouldn't be able to get within a couple hundred yards of it. They'd probably have to abandon the site, and that would lead to further massive radioactive releases. You know, all these nuclear power plants that they put on the coast of Japan and even South Korea are in range of North Korean missiles, for example. You don't have to have a nuclear weapon. You can drop some conventional warheads on spent fuel pools and make most of these countries uninhabitable. So there's a lot of things that don't get talked about problems with nuclear power plants, but I think we will be hearing about them in the future.
So, Steve, in your estimation then, excuse me, nuclear power always a non-starter, no matter where it is?
Well, I think if you just look at the economics right now, they're not, the nuclear power is going down the drain because they can build gas-fired plants cheaper, but they don't, nobody ever talks about what the real cost of trying to store radioactive fuel for 100,000 to a million years. They don't know how to do it. I mean, we've got this giant cavern in New Mexico that was, Nevada, that they were going to bury the stuff in, and then they realized it was, wasn't designed properly, and it was, they choose these areas for political reasons. But how do you isolate anything from the biosphere for a million years? And is it worth it so we can keep all the lights on in St. Louis all night long? I mean, you know, I think the trade-off, the volume of radioactive stuff is small, but it's so incredibly toxic that if it gets into the biosphere, it's toxic at the atomic molecular level, and that's why, you know, when you talk about what happens when it gets inside the body, which is what the safety standards like to not address, I think, and don't properly address, those are the kind of problems that, you know, we have a problem that's going to last for 2,000 or 3,000 human generations that we're creating with this waste, that the next 2,000 human generations are going to have to manage this stuff, and I think that's really... What are the costs of that? You know, I think that's really a terrible mistake to just keep making more of the stuff with the assumption that somehow we'll find a way to take care of it.
Well, gentlemen, I think we're going to have to leave it at that. It's definitely a topic I think that we could easily spend another half hour to an hour discussing, but unfortunately our time today is up. I'd like to thank both of our guests, James Corbett, who is the founder of FukushimaUpdate.com, and Steve Starr, who is the program director of clinical laboratory science at the University of Missouri School of Health Professions, who is also a former board member for Physicians for Social Responsibility. Our lead producer this week is Varvara Fomina, with assistance from Olga Krushtaleva, Jessica Anania, and Batul Hassan. Travis McMillan from the Reynolds Journalism Institute is our technical director, and Pat Akers from KBIA is our audio engineer. Thanks again for listening to this edition of Global Journalist. For Jim Flink, I'm Casey Morrell, and we will see you next time.